Welcome to this afternoon's sessions. I'd like to start by thanking Pfizer for sponsoring our anesthesia track today with Dr. Ralph Harvey. Dr. Harvey's advanced training includes internships and residency training at Cornell University and a fellowship at Cornell's Medical College. He has also worked in private companion practice, and he's certified as a specialist by the ACVA. Dr. Harvey is currently the Associate Professor of Anesthesiology in the Department of the Small Animal Clinical Sciences at the University of Tennessee College of Veterinary Medicine. Our session now is perioperative pain management strategies for small animal patients. Your session number for your evaluation form is 47406. Thank you, Dr. Harvey.
Thank you, Mary, and thank all of you for choosing to spend this nice day in Denver in this room discussing perioperative pain. My task is to help you in your practice and help you with your patients, and I can best achieve that goal with your involvement. So please, as we go through this hour and the subsequent hours, should you choose to stay around for the rest of the show, please do contribute your thoughts and questions and comments just as we go along. Don't save anything till the end. If you'll feel free to interrupt me, you might keep me from falling asleep after lunch. I don't know. We'll see. We'll keep the lights up. That may help also. Well, where are we now? If you heard me talk yesterday, you heard me say that we kind of stand on the shoulders of giants in terms of developments in anesthesia and analgesia. Well, if we're not careful, we sleep on the shoulders of giants if we fail to implement the improvements that are available for us and for our patients. There's been a lot of progress achieved, and it's come through the ambition and innovation and high expectations of all those involved. And those involved include the clients, the owners of those animals, who come to us to care for their animals, to help take care of them. And they presume that we're providing the best in medical care for their benefit, and we can sure do it. There have been advances in pain management with regard to acute pain, and that's the most obvious one. The care of the patient in the immediate perioperative period. With regard to chronic pain, everybody's heard of Remedil, right? Medicam, Deramax, all the other new NSAIDs that are available to manage patients with chronic pain. We also include in that category the patients with cancer. We talked yesterday about cancer pain management. Tremendous advances there as well. There's so many things we can do for our patients that are not rocket science. Okay, it's application of tools that we already have, pharmaceuticals that we already have in our cupboard. It requires an awareness of the need to apply the technologies that we have ready at hand, and skill in applying those technologies, and a willingness to change our therapy as needed because each patient differs. Finally, in the area of critical care analgesia, we talked a little bit about that yesterday. The application of pain management strategies has lagged in critical care in both human patients and in veterinary patients as well. And we'll see some reasons why it's very advantageous in the patient that's critically ill or critically injured to have their pain relieved. There are behavioral indicators that we will focus upon in evaluating animal pain. Behavioral signs are what we need to use most carefully in determining how painful our patients might be and how effective our strategies might be in managing their pain. We'll look for changes in appetite and activity and interaction with the human-animal bond. Changes in their attitude and interaction with other animals as well. We'll see some changes in vocalization, and it's important that we not exaggerate those in scoring the pain of our patients. Changes in posture that are particularly important for some animal species. Levels of aggression that may not otherwise be there. Responses to handling. So we'll make this an interactive evaluation with the animal. There are systemic effects of pain and stress that are maladaptive or disadvantageous, especially when it's carried on for a long period of time. Stress and pain activates the central nervous system, increases sympathetic output, releasing some catecholamines and triggering a stress response that results from a squeeze on the pituitary and the adrenal gland, results in an increased level of blood sugar, insulin resistance, cytokine production and release, the release of acute phase proteins, neutrophilic leukocytosis, and immunological and hematologic changes that are maladaptive in a chronic pain situation. Diagrammatically, we'll see it here. And I want to emphasize this diagram because we can see in it opportunities to intervene. We have transduction of pain at the area of the tissue damage, transmission through nerves, modulation with incoming signals to the spinal cord and brainstem, and we have accentuation of those signals and inhibition of those signals by descending impulses from the central nervous system. We then have transmission up the spinal cord to the brainstem and interpretation at the higher centers. And we can intervene at each of those levels in a multimodal fashion to relieve pain and minimize stress in the animals. Another diagrammatic representation is here. The result of trauma is hemorrhage and edema in those tissues, resulting in some cardiovascular and perfusion deficits. We also have that pain and anxiety that triggers that neuroendocrine response. Together, they result in a change in metabolic function, a change in cardiac and respiratory function, change in renal function and GI response, and immunological effects. And again, these are maladaptive when carried on for too long a period of time. Now, we can diminish the pain in the central nervous system at the level of interpretation in the brain. But if we don't diminish it at the level of transmission, we still have those maladaptive neuroendocrine responses in our patients. So as we go along in this session and our later session on local anesthetics, we'll emphasize the importance of controlling the transmission of pain to the spinal cord and brainstem as a key factor in preventing that stress response. Well, pain is now recognized as a fifth vital sign in human patients, perhaps the fourth vital sign in veterinary patients, since we still don't measure blood pressure in all of our patients. And certainly, veterinarians are moving toward blood pressure screening. Now that many of you have blood pressure measuring technologies in your practice, whether it's a Doppler, non-invasive blood pressure device, or something else, those pieces of equipment are being applied more and more broadly in screening applications. And we find that some animals are hypertensive. We find that some animals are hypotensive also. So we're coming to the point where blood pressure screening and blood pressure determination is another vital sign in our patients. And then pain is either the fourth or fifth vital sign and must be evaluated for each patient. In fact, the AHA standard requires that pain be evaluated in every patient at each evaluation. We're going to spend a fair amount of time discussing that evaluation also. Pain's been defined in human patients as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience that's associated with either an actual or a potential tissue damage. And that definition can be applied to veterinary as well as human patients. The AHA pain management standard states that pain assessment using a standardized scale or scoring system is required in the medical record for every patient evaluation. So we make recordings of the temperature, pulse, and respiration, some physiologic parameters. There are sensitivity measurements that can be applied in our patients, and we integrate those to come up with a pain scale, some way to quantify the level of discomfort in that animal from this little guy over here that's quite happy to this one who's not. How are you feeling today? Feeling pretty good? No. How good? Or if somebody's got a headache, how bad does it hurt? Real bad, you know? Well, what do you mean real bad? Well, it's a throbbing pain or it's a stabbing pain. It hurts right here. It hurts everywhere. So you can apply some descriptors to it. And we can't ask the dogs and cats to do that for us. Okay. So I might ask you more simply, if you were to rate your pain on a scale of 1 to 10, how is it? With 0 being no pain at all and 10 being the worst pain that you can imagine for whatever condition this is that's bothering you. Maybe you have a disc compression in your neck, or maybe you have a toothache, or maybe you're tired of sitting here listening to lectures. Okay. But if you were to rank your pain or scale it on a basis of 0 to 10, you're coming up with a quantification that might be useful in terms of treating that pain. So if you discuss it with your physician for a chronic painful situation, you might say, well, today it's about a 3, it's all right. But if you come back the next time and it's an 8, that physician, he or she, is going to get more involved in treating it and hopefully bring you back down to a 3, 4, 2, 1, something that's manageable. Now, how can we apply that in our animals? So we can't get them to give us a number. There are a lot of options for evaluation of pain. There are simple descriptive scales, for instance, that lancinating, dull, throbbing, aching, stabbing pain. Numerical rating systems, the 0 to 10, for instance. There are composite scales that are based on a number of indices. For instance, if your heart rate is elevated, you might get a 2 or 3 point increase in your scale for that elevation. If your respiratory rate is elevated, you might get a 1 or 2 point elevation in your pain scale for that. Okay. If you're limping, you might get a 1, 2, or 3 addition to your scale for that, so a composite scale. What we've come down to in our hospital and many institutions are using to come into compliance with the American Animal Hospital Association standards is an interactive visual analog scale. We evaluate the animal based on observation of its behaviors or discussion with the owner, and we also include an interactive component. So we'll approach the animal, see how it responds to our approach, see how it interacts with other animals as well. And then if we can, we'll touch the animal, see how it responds to that. If it's had an operative procedure, we'll touch the area gently around the operative site, being careful not to elicit any aggressive response or to hurt the animal. So we make it an interactive scale, and then on the basis of that behavioral evaluation, discussion with the owner, or direct evaluation with the animal and interaction with the animal, we come up with a score. Okay. And what we do is apply it on a line. We'll have a 10-centimeter line that's scratched off in the record, and we'll make a mark there from one end to the other, with one end being zero pain and the other end being the worst pain that we can imagine for that particular condition. And then after that mark's placed on there, somebody may come along and put a 10-centimeter ruler on there and then measure how far from zero did that person mark to really quantify it. Okay? I don't want to have the marks on there to start with because that's going to bias me. But if they put the ruler on there and measure, okay, it's over at 36. Next time, later in the day, after therapeutic intervention, they come back and I'll make a mark on another line. Hopefully I'm down lower. Maybe it's a 12, maybe it's a 45, maybe it's more painful. Okay? So that's the interactive visual analog scale. Let's look at this scale and several of the others because it's an important part of pain management. It's an important part of analgesic care in all of our practices, and the American Animal Hospital Association recognizes that and emphasizes that evaluation of pain, recognition and evaluation are the most difficult things that we deal with right now. Because again, we have the tools. We have the pharmaceuticals. We have the techniques. We know some suggested drug doses. The most difficult thing that we face is evaluating how uncomfortable is that animal and did they show a response to our intervention. Okay? There are a lot of factors that influence the pain scores. Certainly the temperament of the animal. If we have an animal that has an underlying aggressive or submissive characteristic to its behavior, that was likely to influence the scale. If they cry out, vocalization has been found to be unduly emphasized by people who are scaling pain. Perhaps it's been argued we should pay more attention to things like body posture, that tense abdomen, the hunched back, than we should to an animal crying out. But we as humans are very sensitive to vocalization. Locomotion, certainly in terms of gait abnormalities and lameness, that's one that's been quantified very nicely and has been used in a lot of the studies of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug efficacy. Many other behavior changes. Let's look at some of them. Okay? But we do individualize the pain management and scaling to each animal. These two species, or perhaps these three species, will behave very differently in response to pain. There are species-specific characteristic behaviors that they'll show. Rabbits are very unlikely to vocalize, for instance. Humans very likely to vocalize, dogs somewhere in the middle. But rabbits very unlikely to vocalize. Everybody heard a rabbit scream in pain? Oh, that's terrible, isn't it? When we interact with that animal that is potentially painful, we need to be careful and we need to teach our staff members to be careful in interacting with that animal because we don't want to elicit an aggressive response. In the dog, there are behaviors that have been listed as potential indicators of pain, and these include those changes in body position, a glazed or dull facial expression. I want you to look for that later on in the little video clip we have of a collie. I want you to look for his facial expression, the first thing you see on there. Attention seeking and whining in dogs. Licking the painful area. And unlike cats, a tendency not to hide the painful body part. In cats, a poor grooming or lack of grooming is characteristic of the painful animal. Hissing or aggression, if that painful part is manipulated or touched. a tendency to hide, dissociation or distraction from the environment, and again, vocalization is more rare in the cat than in the dog. And there are behaviors that have been described as common in chronic pain also. Those include a dull or grouchy or grumpy temperament. So we've all seen the old cat or the old dog that's like that. And sometimes it's because they're painful, whether it's from degenerative joint disease or other ills of old age. Changes in posture and locomotion, as we mentioned. Changes in grooming. A reduced activity level. The old dog that just lies around. The old cat that just lies around. We put that old dog on Rimadyl and we see them chasing the tennis ball. You remember the advertisement for Rimadyl? Had the family sitting around, they're on the back porch, woman's in a recliner, and everybody's really trashed out. And you can hear this sound going off, ba-doom, ba-doom, ba-doom. And you just know the dog's running around. You can't tell what's going along. And she talks about being at the beach or playing in the park all day, and everybody's worn off. And then the camera kind of pans back, and she's firing a tennis ball shooter. And the dog's still charging after that. And the implication is the old dog's been put on Rimadyl, and it's now able to keep going and keep going like the Energizer Bunny. You've heard about the old cats that have been put on meloxicam. They used to lay on top of the sofa in the windowsill all day and never get up, never move around. They're put on the oral meloxicam or another NSAID, and all of a sudden they're kittens again. They're playing and they're running around. Okay? So they've changed that activity level. There can be reductions in food and water consumption, in part because they don't feel like getting up. And then inappropriate urination and defecation. Maybe the old cat doesn't feel like getting to the litter box anymore. With regard to different species beyond the dog and the cat, I've included a few here because there are behaviors that have been documented in the horse and ruminants and pigs and others. Certainly the horse is unlikely to vocalize. But a base-wide stance, severe weight loss, a dull expression. In ruminants, an isolation from the herd. In pigs, reluctance to get around, reduced social interaction, which is very unusual in pigs, but little appetite change, sort of like the dog. There are documented biases in our ability to evaluate pain. We are very sensitive to vocalization and extremes in behavior. With regard to lameness evaluation, it's influenced by the joint. Some joints are easier to pick up as being dysfunctional. A lot of observer bias in that. And caretakers or owners of animals have an expectation of perceived pain that may influence or bias their evaluation. We look for sudden changes in behavior. Again, vocalization, aggression, lack of response. Here's a little video clip. Dull expression. Now watch what happens here. Oh, watch when he goes back. Okay. So that dog has kind of a dull facial expression. We'll do it one more time. Kind of dull, sitting there. As soon as that limb is touched, the dog shows some aggression. He doesn't like it. And you just approach that leg again, and he doesn't. It's not very subtle, is it? Changes in locomotion. Again, lameness, reduced speed. Animals dragging their leg, being uncoordinated. Difficulty in moving. Failure to climb the stairs. Uncoordinated movements or incoordinated movements. Running, flying, and I presume that means fleeing. Or limited movement, hiding, particularly in the cat. There are a lot of options, if we already started to talk about, with regard to evaluating pain. Those simple descriptive scales, the numerical rating scale, the composite scale, we're going to look a little bit more detail, and the visual analog scale. Many other scales have been developed, and we could spend hours talking about them. The simple descriptive scales, they're a modified verbal rating system based on simple observation. There's also a scale that's been used quite a bit in human hospitals, and a scale like this is used as a card. Even with very young children, children are 3 or 4 years old, they'll be shown a card like this with a smiley face on one end and a very frowny face on the other end and say, how do you feel today? Just point out which way do you feel today. So little kids, you know, 3 or 4 years old can use this. And little children with cancer, for instance, have been known to very accurately be able to and reproducibly be able to indicate their own level of discomfort with a scale like this, adding much more power to our ability to treat that pain. The different facial expressions is not so useful for us in veterinary medicine, We look at these dogs, and I don't think that first dog ever had a bad day, in spite of the fact he may be quite painful. He certainly may have some degenerative joint disease, but that's a happy fellow looking by his face. And yet you look at that next to the last one, I'm not sure he ever had such a happy day, according to his facial expression. So those facial expressions are not so useful in our domestic animals. So here's a representation of that numerical rating scale. So we pick a number. Okay. And so we're going to pick a number between 0 and 10, with that 0 being no pain and 10 being the worst pain we might imagine for that animal for that condition. So that's just a numerical rating system where we're going to pick a number. This is a representation of one of the composite numerical rating scales, where again vocalization is attributed a score of 0 to 2, movement a score of 0 to 2, agitation along this scale a rating of or a score of 0 to 3. The Glasgow Composite Pain Scale is based on an evaluation of the dog's posture, their level of activity, vocalization, whether they're paying attention to the wound. There are descriptor differential scales that are based on physiologic measurements as well. Some of these have been developed at a variety of institutions, Children's Hospital in Ontario, University of Melbourne Pain Scale, modifications of many of the above. We used a modified Melbourne Pain Scale in an evaluation of perioperative analgesics in dogs receiving TPLO procedure for cruciate ligament rupture. So we evaluated behavioral indices as well as physiologic parameters like blood pressure and heart rate to come up with a total score for those animals. The Melbourne Pain Scale has these different descriptors, these different categories, with a potential number of points to be accumulated and added together. A scale that's been used in osteoarthritis research is shown here, with a variety of indices for locomotion and also some points added for changes in mood, positive behaviors, and changes in vocalization, negative behaviors that can be either subtracted from or added to that numeric score. Some of these get kind of cumbersome to use on a daily basis, particularly in a clinical application. And that's why most institutions do not use these composite scales. It's one of the reasons that we've come to use the interactive visual analog scale, because an individual can score an animal on a basis of less than a minute. So here's a representation of that visual analog scale to evaluate pain management. No pain to worst pain ever. So we have a line drawn on our record. We see an animal like this after it recovers, not while it's under anesthesia, but after it recovers. Perhaps it might come up with a scale, for an example, of a 77. So the individual comes by and marks a line, and then afterwards we can measure it and see that's 77 millimeters. So that's a visual analog score. After treatment, we make a mark, then measure it, come up with 16. So right now, for purposes of argument, that's pretty good treatment. Later on, if the analgesic efficacy starts to fade with the passage of time, we'll see an animal change in its stance there, and we may come up with a little higher score. Okay, so you can kind of start to get an appreciation of how these scores can be used to quantify the pain and then to help us guide therapy. There are species-specific variations in the reliability of the behaviors, so the application of these scores requires training for our personnel. We need to come together as a clinic and decide how we're going to evaluate things like vocalization, things like lameness, things like response to palpation. So we come together as a group in each of our hospitals so that we mean the same things by our scores. So it's going to require us to do a little bit of on-site training in each hospital. Reassessment after treatment should be done by the same individual if at all possible. Let's move on to what we can do about it, okay? You saw this image yesterday, this slide yesterday. The first of the analgesic strategies available must always be thorough nursing care. Sometimes altering the environment helps, maybe turning the lights down in recovery area, maybe petting the animal, maybe leaving them alone. Certainly opioids, the drugs like morphine, hydromorphone, buprenorphine, butorphanol, the opioids come very high on the list. Local and regional anesthesia we're going to talk about extensively in the next lecture and a little bit more in this lecture. The alpha-2 agonists were increasingly finding application for very low doses of alpha-2 agonists like Domitor in terms of pain management. And there are many other strategies as well. I know a lot of you are using amitriptyline, amantadine, gabapentin, some more advanced strategies as complementary means of relieving pain. The principles in pain management are preemptive analgesia, balanced analgesia, and a willingness to dose to effect. So we'll apply those every time we treat a patient in pain. Treat early, use a multimodal or balanced approach, and be willing to give more if it doesn't work. Realize we're treating the patient, not the pharmacology textbook, or not what I've told you in some lecture. One of the more advanced modalities we use is neuroaxial or epidural application of analgesics. We're using a lot of epidural morphine, and it's not just for rear limb orthopedic procedures either. We use it for a lot of soft tissue abdominal procedures. We use it for thoracotomies. We use it for forelimb procedures as well. Epidural morphine provides a great analgesic contribution throughout the body. Yes, sir. That's a very good question. His question is, how do I feel about the use of a preservative-free morphine versus a parenteral or preservative-containing morphine? The best idea is to use the Duramorph for preservative-free formulation, and that's what we started using a number of years ago. That's what we're still using. I make a strong argument for people to use the parenteral morphine, however. A lot of the experts who helped develop this technology in veterinary medicine are indeed using the regular preservative-containing morphine. It is a much more concentrated preparation. Once it is diluted, there is a very minuscule amount of preservative present. And a lot of the experts in our field have published their opinion, their expert opinion, that the preservative-containing morphine can be used for epidural injection. You're on sound footing if you choose to use that preservative-containing preparation. Since we started using the preservative-free preparation, we have felt, up until this point, obliged to continue doing so. Okay. The technique is procedurally easy. We teach all of our students to do epidurals, and our technicians actually teach our students to do the epidurals. It's much easier technically than a lot of the intravenous catheters that we place. Okay. I do not have a reference on the dilution technique, but I can tell you the dose that we'll use. It's a tenth of a milligram per kilogram of the morphine, and the regular, the Duramorph is 1 milligram per mil, and the parenteral morphine is usually 15 milligrams per mil. So once we dilute that, that's a pretty small amount of preservative present. And there are a variety of different preservatives that are used. We have numerous benefits to be derived from an epidural injection. One of the foremost is a reduction in the requirement for our other anesthetics. So we can avoid using a lot of the more dangerous things. We can avoid using such a high level of inhalants and such a high level of injectables, of course. We often will achieve 24 hours of substantial analgesia with an epidural injection of morphine. We have a decreased stress response, particularly when we add a local anesthetic. We do usually use the preservative-free Duramorph, but morphine, USP, can also be used. And customarily, we'll often add bupivacaine, particularly if it is for a procedure in the rear half of the body. Okay. The procedures have been well described in the literature, and again, we teach all of our students and technicians how to perform it. A lot of people using duragesic patches. How many people have ever used the duragesic patches? How many people are still using them? Not as many. I'm kind of the same boat. Used to use them a lot more than I do now. We talked yesterday extensively about duragesic patches when it comes to the cancer pain patient. We also talked yesterday about the use of duragesic patches in feline patients, particularly with declaw procedures. They can deliver a consistent level of strong opioid analgesia for 3 days in the dog, maybe 5 days in the cat. Their use is strictly off-label and not supported by the industry, the pharmaceutical industry. So precautions are very important, but they can be powerful. As an alternative, we use a lot of fentanyl by injection now, constant rate infusions. sort of like the morphine, lidocaine, ketamine infusions that many of you might be using. How many people are using MLK, morphine, lidocaine, ketamine infusions? Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit later also. With regard to local anesthetics, just a touch now and more in the next hour. Lidocaine's the prototypic. We're using a lot of bupivacaine and a fair amount of articaine or septicaine. The last one is the drug we use in many dental applications. We use the locals for regional and specific nerve blocks, infiltration of a surgical wound, neuroaxial applications, and intravenously with regard to lidocaine. Very easy, very effective, very, very inexpensive to use the local anesthetics. If I need to go in the hospital and have something done surgically, I'm going to take a bottle of Marcaine in with me. And if they don't use it, I will. You know, boy, it just works so well. It's so much safer than the other things we do for analgesia. It's so easy. A little bottle of Marcaine costs us $1.60. Even the vial of septicaine we use for our dental applications is 80 cents. Lidocaine is dirt cheap. It makes sense to use it. With regard to the constant rate infusions, we get a great analgesic contribution and a reduction in the anesthetic requirements. Okay, so a reduced inhalant needed, improvement in blood pressure as a result of that. The use of lidocaine as a constant rate infusion is prokinetic. It keeps the guts moving. Extremely valuable for abdominal surgery. We, in fact, pick this technique up from those who are using lidocaine infusions in horses for colic surgery to maintain gut function. Yes. Question here, do other folks find in doing dental blocks, specifically with lidocaine and bupivacaine or a mixture of lidocaine and bupivacaine, do people find an increase in hemorrhage in their dental procedures? When's one hand going up? Well, I'll tell you a little bit later a way to minimize it, and it is in part through the use of this newer, this alternative local anesthetic. Articaine is the local anesthetic. It's combined with epinephrine. And the product is called septicaine. But you can also use a lidocaine preparation that contains a vasoconstrictor or add a small amount to it. And that'll help minimize the hemorrhage. The vasoconstrictors are added primarily to delay absorption of the drug so it lasts longer. But they will decrease hemorrhage a little bit as well. The lidocaine as a constant rate infusion also provides an anti-inflammatory effect. It tends to be a scavenger of reactive oxygen species, what we used to call free radicals. Again, the CRI of lidocaine is extremely cost-effective. As an example of technique, we use a loading dose of 1 or 2 milligrams of lidocaine intravenously over 2 to 3 minutes and deliver a constant rate infusion of 50 to 100 micrograms per kilogram per minute, either by a syringe pump or putting it in a bag. And a very simple recipe there is for you on the lower part of this slide, an easy setup method. I'll kind of leave this up for a minute and walk you through it. Take a 1 liter bag of fluids and throw away 68 cc's of that fluid. And then add 68 cc's of 2% lidocaine. If you then drip that to the patient at 1 cc per pound per hour, you'll achieve a dose rate of 50 micrograms per kilogram per minute. Now we often make a CRI of lidocaine, morphine, and ketamine, and we'll throw away 72 mils from that bag of fluid. Add 68 mils of lidocaine, 4 cc's of morphine, and 0.6 cc's of ketamine, and give it at the same 1 cc per pound per hour. That gets us in the low to moderate therapeutic range on that CRI for the lidocaine and the morphine and the ketamine. And then we'll adjust it as needed in a post-operative setting. Yes? Yes, for the modification of this to make it a morphine and ketamine in addition to the lidocaine, instead of throwing away 68 mils, throw away 72 mils from your bag of fluids and then add 68 cc's of 2% lidocaine plus 4 cc's of parenteral morphine, that's 15 milligrams per mil or 60 milligrams of morphine, and then also add 0.6 cc's of ketamine, which is also 60 milligrams. And then if we'll drip that to the patient at 1 cc per pound per hour, we'll achieve a low to moderate therapeutic level of all three drugs in the patient. And then adjust that as necessary. And we use it very, very often in the operative and post-operative period. We may have to decrease that infusion rate to allow the patient a more rapid return to consciousness, especially with the morphine being a profound cough suppressant. We'll slow that drip down as they start to wake up, lift their head up. If they're showing any sign of pain, we can go up on the drip rate. If not, we'll leave it where it is and allow them to wake up comfortably. Comment back here? Yes, sir. How do I feel about mixing all three as opposed to one drug per bag? I feel great about it. Yeah, patient does too. And it seems to be stable in preparation. It's been evaluated. This seems to be quite stable in preparation. If we give too much, the animal may show some signs of nausea. If we give too much local anesthetic, and we'll talk about this later, they'll show signs of CNS irritability. And I have seen it in patients at the higher levels. We get a little bit of twitching, a little bit of increased nervousness. That can progress to seizure activity. Slow down your drip rate or discontinue it. Treat the seizure if you need to with a little bit of Valium and go on. Yes? Yeah. If I could hear your question correctly, and please stop me if I haven't, but when do I choose between lidocaine versus lidocaine morphine ketamine? Or lidocaine fentanyl. If I want a prokinetic effect only, if I don't stock morphine in my practice, unfortunately, if I don't, you know, then I'll use the lidocaine or maybe lidocaine ketamine. You can also come up with similar recipes for other opioids. Some have been published. Okay. If I'm managing pain with periodic injections of hydromorphone, for instance, I may do that and then add to it just a lidocaine CRI. Okay. And then provide incremental doses of the opiate in form, maybe hydromorphone injection. So there are a variety of ways we can apply these. Also, if I'm treating a cat, I won't use a lidocaine CRI, because in cats, the analgesic dose is very, very close to the toxic dose. Okay, so this recipe for lidocaine is really just for dogs. Yes? For cats, what CRI do you use? Often fentanyl. And fentanyl can be, depending on your drug supplier, fentanyl can be either very expensive or very inexpensive. Depends on where you're getting it. Okay. And I thank you very much for your questions. If I don't get through all the slides, but I answer your questions, that's great. If I get through all the slides and I don't answer your questions, that's not great. Okay? Agreed? Good. Thanks. Other options for CRIs, and there are a lot of them. Low-dose ketamine, as we mentioned. Fentanyl, as we mentioned. Morphine by itself also, lots of others. Let's talk a little bit about the NSAIDs. Tremendous variety available for us, and it's wonderful. We have a variety that almost approaches what they have in human medicine. So we can take advantage of that because all patients differ in their susceptibility to analgesic efficacy with the NSAIDs and also their susceptibility to side effects that are undesirable. Some people cannot tolerate ibuprofen, right? And they might get a good result with naproxen or Aleve. They might need to use Feldene, for instance, or something else. And that can change over time. Okay? I used to tolerate ibuprofen, and now I can't anymore. Okay? I know people who have been on one NSAID for a chronic degenerative joint disease, and their physician puts them on another one every month or two or three or four. And if you're going to switch NSAIDs, most of the pharmacologists suggest that you allow a withdrawal period of as much as 2 weeks. Now, while you're doing that, you might need to cover that animal with something else if they have severe degenerative joint disease. You might be able to use acetaminophen in a dog. You might be able to use buprenorphine in a cat, for instance. But most of the experts recommend a withdrawal period when you're switching from one NSAID to another because of the increased susceptibility to toxicity when we use combined NSAIDs. I've listed acetaminophen in parentheses because it's often lumped with the nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, but please do recognize that it's not an anti-inflammatory agent, and as such it acts quite differently. It presumably acts at COX-3 receptors in the central nervous system, but does not block inflammation. And obviously we're not going to use acetaminophen in cats. But acetaminophen in combination with the traditional nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs in humans and in dogs is extremely powerful. Okay. I know a lot of people who will take, for instance, one ibuprofen plus one Tylenol instead of taking two or three ibuprofen and two or three Tylenol. Synergistic interaction, it's very beneficial. Okay. Well, part of the advances in NSAIDs have been through recognizing how they work and where they work. There is tremendous individual variability in efficacy and in safety. It does require the skill in our application and management of the patients and management of potential toxicities. We're looking for drugs that are either COX-2 selective or COX-2 specific. And the difference between those is more than semantic, but it depends on what test you're using. There are cytoprotective measures that are available. And there is a dual pathway cyclooxygenase and lipoxygenase effective NSAID available. Unfortunately, it has, one of the worst vehicles imaginable for dogs. It's the sticky little tablet. It's in Tapoxilin or Zubrin. It's a great drug, but not many dogs like it. We have a real paradigm shift regarding NSAID toxicity that's been going on as the additional drugs have been introduced. Okay, we've worried about different types of toxicity with all the new NSAIDs. And I would argue that these can be anticipated, can be managed, and there are tremendous advances for our patients in management of chronic pain as a result of the availability of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. It's been a great advance in veterinary medicine. We have got some description of the variety of drugs available: Daracoxib, Tapoxilin, Ketoprofen, Meloxicam. The injectables, we have Carprofen, Ketoprofen, and Meloxicam. Very valuable for me as an anesthesiologist to have something I can put in with a needle. We may have others coming out in the future. There's some suggestion that the onset of action is not much faster with many of the medications when given by injection compared to oral administration. But if I have an animal that's being fasted or otherwise is not suitable to give it a tablet, it's nice to have an injectable option. A lot of options in relieving pain. How are we doing for time, Mary? 8 minutes. I have a few cases I want to go through with you, and I welcome you to interrupt with comments and questions also. So we kind of zoomed through a bit of that. I do want to emphasize the importance of these concepts in scaling pain and evaluating pain, because that is going to be a key to our application of these good tools. You want to guess this dog's name? This is Lucky. It really is Lucky. And Lucky was in the back of a pickup truck. It's always a bad idea. His owner had the foresight to put a leash on him and connect it in the truck, but it was a long one. And so Lucky jumped out or fell out and was dragged along behind the truck and was a real wreck. He was a real mess. Had multiple fractures, a lot of contusions, a little cranial trauma. So we applied multimodal analgesia in this pup. Because of his head trauma, we didn't want to give a large systemic dose of opiate that would decrease his ventilation and increase his CO2 and then reflexively increase his intracranial pressure. So we used an opiate with a limited respiratory depression action. I believe we used buprenorphine in Lucky, systemic dose. We also gave him an epidural with Duramorph and bupivacaine. We may have put an epidural catheter in there because we knew he was going to need some analgesics for a number of days. We also put him on a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug because we had so many mediators of inflammation being released in this pup. It's a really nice dog, but you know, he hasn't breathed well since he was born. Okay, so you take a dog, break his phallic animal like this, and you anesthetize him, he breathes even poorly, more poorly. He has that triad of upper respiratory problems, principal problems, the stenotic nares. Everybody looks at the dog and they can see the alar folds closed. He has the elongated soft palate. You can hear that flapping in the breeze, and he snores and snorts. The third primary component, structural component, that a lot of people don't think about is the hypoplastic or small diameter trachea, because it's just not as obvious. But that has tremendous implications for the resistance to air movement. And also in our placement of an endotracheal tube, we need a small one for these guys. So all of those things increase the resistance to airflow and make it difficult for him to breathe. Then we anesthetize him, we depress his ventilatory drive. Postoperatively, with total ear canal ablation, we then put a bandage around his head, which fortunately we've gotten away from in recent years, especially an elasticon bandage. This dog's lucky to still be alive, actually, with that. So we're choking him, he has respiratory depression, and he hasn't breathed well a day in his life. Okay, so what do we do for him post-operatively? One thing is, we'll check that bandage, okay? I'm going to feel the ventral caudal aspect of that bandage right where it would choke him. It always gets tighter, okay? You know that. It always gets tighter. He flexes his neck, the tissue bunches up, it rolls up, it always gets tighter. So I feel the ventral caudal aspect, and I will cut them. I cut almost every one that I place myself, even trying to be real careful. I'll cut a V and let it gap open, okay? In terms of pain management, I believe we also gave him an epidural. Again, it works from tip of the tail to tip of the nose. I did a local infiltration of bupivacaine in the area, and it's hard to block that effectively, okay? And I believe I also had him on a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. And I may have used a little bit of ketamine in that procedure also because it augments the opiate analgesia. This little guy is facing a thoracotomy. So among his applications, you see he's got a fentanyl patch that was placed on there the night before. And finally, this real nice dog is a Catahoula leopard dog. She's a real sweetie, popular hunting breed in the southeast. And she was used for hunting boar and bear. And the owners of this dog were training their dogs with a pet boar. Okay. And they thought they had it covered, literally, because they had a Kevlar vest for the dog. But a boar is a pretty smart creature, so it just lifts underneath the Kevlar vest with its tusk and eviscerates this dog. So she's presented, you know, abdominal contents spilled out on the ground. So they kind of scooped her up, you know, leaves and sticks and dirt and rocks. Brought her in, we wrap her up, you know, clean her out. She's a real mess. She's definitely one that benefited from the lidocaine CRI to maintain gut motility. Any questions or comments? Mary's about to chase me away. Yes, sir. Yes. 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 The question is, how much does this fentanyl patch that we had on the previous patient, how much does that contribute? Depends on the size of patch, obviously, size of dog. We have pretty good absorption, pretty good pharmacokinetics and dynamics with this drug. If we have an appropriately sized patch, I'm just going to arbitrarily say about a 30% to a 50% reduction. I would like to see the animal, when I come in the hospital in the morning and look at it, patch has been put on the night before, I'd like to see that animal look a little bit goofy. I want to see him just a little slow, stumbling around the cage, showing some behavioral sign that they do indeed have a plasma level of fentanyl, and then I can use that as my pre-med opiate. Okay? Then I would expect it to reduce 30 to 50% the requirement for opiates, maybe 30% the requirement for inhaled anesthetics during the procedure. Yes, sir?
Do you avoid fentanyl in GI surgery?
Question is, do I avoid fentanyl in GI surgery because of decreased motility? No, sir, I don't. All of the opioids have the potential for decreased motility, especially the pure agonists. And yet, surgical manipulation is a much more powerful deterrent of gut motility than are the opiates. Chronic administration, especially in humans, is associated with a lot of ileus and constipation. In our dogs, it's not as bad a problem, but adding the lidocaine will really help compensate for that. I sure will. Yes, sure will. Any question back here? In what situations do I use the alpha-2s? One application that I brought up yesterday in talking with someone after discussion was the animal post-operatively that gets a dose of an opioid. It seems uncomfortable. He's noisy. Is he uncomfortable or is he stressed? Okay, is he excited and dysphoric? If I'm in doubt if he's painful or not, I'm going to give some opiate. Okay, so if he becomes quiet and looks comfortable, that's great. Answer is there. If he's not quiet and comfortable, does he still need more analgesic or is he just dysphoric? I could give a benzodiazepine or a phenthiazine tranquilizer, or I could give a really low dose of an alpha-2. And if the animal is reasonably healthy, not a dying old geriatric debilitated animal, and especially if I'm using a very low dose, I'll use a very low dose of Domator, maybe a half to one microgram per kilogram, very low dose. And often that will augment the analgesia and provide sedation so that animal will sleep. If it turns out the animal is still dysphoric, if the animal is still dysphoric, then I might consider giving another tranquilizer, okay? But if that animal then shows signs that I'm not comfortable with, And I'm always reminded of the northern breed that could live in a snowbank and subsist on a pound of horse meat and pull a sled all day and be happy as a clam. But if you put it in the hospital and stick a 22-gauge needle in its butt, it's going to scream its head off. Okay? So if I have a dog like that that's just dysphoric and I regret having given all these drugs and I want to get away from it, a beauty of the alpha-2s is obviously that it can be reversed. Okay? So in a post-operative setting, that's one way that I'm using the alpha-2s increasingly. And one of the great proponents of alpha-2s, one of the people who developed the many techniques we use, is Dr. Bill Tranquilli at Illinois. Great name for an anesthesiologist, Tranquilli. So Dr. Tranquilli came up with a lot of good applications and recipes and strategies for using alpha-2s, including Domator. And years ago, he recommended a microdose approach with Domator where he'd use the Domator and Torbogesic. And I think most everybody now is using Domator in combinations with various opiates at lower than the bottle recommended dose. I asked Bill if he felt at that time whether the cardiovascular effects, hemodynamic effects, were highly dose dependent, and he thought they were not highly dose dependent. But at that time, we were only going down to about 5 to 10 micrograms per kilogram. Now we're using much lower dose, and there is some dose dependence to the cardiovascular side effects. Okay. Yes? Yes. Question is about aspirin. I list it as a prototypic non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. I'm not using it in animals anymore. And yet it does have some good applications. I know some people recommend it as part of anti-clot type medication. Anybody using aspirin as an analgesic? Or how about in other applications? It's really fallen out of favor. In humans as well. Remarkable drug, though. Remarkable drug. Other questions or comments? I thank you so much for your involvement. Thank you.